It's a really, really pervasive, overarching thing that eating more, being bigger, taking up space, being large, being a bigger size, weighing more is the worst possible outcome that could happen. And I could argue with you that having low bone density and getting early onset osteoporosis and sarcopenia and muscle wasting, which is going to have you at a higher risk of injury as you get older, losing your cycle, losing your period, having all kinds of hormonal disruptions. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I would argue that that whole host of symptoms are much worse than being a larger pant size, actually.
It isn't about being perfect. It's about being better. Hello, my name is Dr. Stephanie Stima, and I host expert discussions with thought leaders in all facets of health, including nutrition, fitness, hormones, stress management, performance, recovery, longevity, health span, and energy production. On this show, we discuss complex science, but then we also alchemize it into actionable everyday living. The ultimate goal with the show is to assist you in making informed decisions about your health, and to catapult you into being the hero in your own life. Hello, my friends, and welcome back to another episode of Better with Dr. Stephanie. It's me, your host, Dr. Stephanie Estima. And today I bring you a conversation all about muscle science for women. I am speaking with my good friend, Ashley Van Houten. And a little bit about Ashley. She is a health coach, a speaker, podcast host. She is the author of one of the only nose-to-tail organ meat-centric cookbooks called It Takes Guts. She's also an author of a book called Carnivore-ish. She created and co-hosts the Muscle Science for Women podcast, and she has developed a range of coaching programs and workshops called Muscle Science for Women. She has another one called the Strength Training for Women Specialist Coaching Certification and the Jacked Back Pull-Up Program. Love the title of that one. So as you might imagine, Ashley and I have a lot in common. You'll see our friendship and our respect, mutual respect for each other, hopefully throughout the conversation. And we talk a lot about, there's two main conversations that happen here. One is around muscle science and muscle hypertrophy and muscle-centric medicine and thoughts around muscle building for women. And then the second part of the conversation is focused around nutrition for women. So in the muscle piece, if you will, we talk about how you can, or if, is it a good idea to be building muscle and losing fat simultaneously? We talk about bulking and cutting. We talk about time under tension and perceived effort. We talk about partial reps versus full range of motion, which is better, or is there a place for both? We talk about different concepts around progressive overload for building muscle. We talk about foundational movement patterns, exercise snacks. Oh God, such a rich conversation. And when we move into the nutrition piece, we talk about calories, we talk about creatine, collagen, carnivore, supplements. We talk about maybe my own trauma around liver and onions, and sounds like she's going to help me get over that little spoiler there for you. It is a wonderful conversation, whether you are a seasoned expert or you are new to weight training, new to this idea of more protein, maybe eating a little bit more than we've been told. We dismantle a lot of the myths that are sort of shoved down women's throats. And I did say that unintentionally, but it sounds really good now that we're talking about nutrition. So please enjoy my conversation with Ashley Van Houten. Omega-3s are pretty much involved in improving all aspects of human function, from its muscle-preserving effects to reducing cardiovascular disease and death, improving vision and protecting against DNA damage and oxidative stress. We need to be taking an omega-3 daily. Fish Oil Plus from Body Bio elevates your health with a phospholipid-bound omega-3, which is DHA and EPA, as well as specialized pro-resolving mediators, which are designed to actively reduce excess inflammation in the body. Fish Oil Plus capsules are sourced from herring caviar from the pristine icy waters of Norway. Each batch undergoes stringent testing to ensure it is free from heavy metals, mercury, and other contaminants, and as well remains free from oxidation from production to consumption by you. This Fish Oil Plus, alongside the Balance Oil, are the two oils that I use for myself and my family on a daily basis. We take it straight up with a tablespoon, but it also mixes really well into smoothies, and you can also drizzle it over your salad. Head over to bodybio.com/better and use code BETTER at checkout to get 15% off your first order.
Essential fatty acids create better skin, hair, and nails, repair age-related damage to cells, and activate pathways that regulate sleep and mood. Fatty 15 is a different kind of essential fatty acid that helps to reverse 36 clinically relevant and age-associated changes at the cellular level, effectively protecting your cells and you against age-related breakdown. It is a stable nutrient that reduces oxidative damage and acts like an armor for your cells, keeping them young and healthy. It helps with your liver, joint health, heart health, immune health, and it activates longevity pathways like AMP kinase for smoother functioning joints, deeper sleep, healthier hair, skin, and nails. Fatty 15 is on a mission to replenish your C15 levels and restore your long-term health. You can get an additional 15% off of their 90-day subscription starter kit if you go to fatty15.com/better and use code BETTER at checkout. That's FATTY, the numbers 15.com/BETTER, and use code BETTER at checkout.
Welcome to The Better Show. Ashley, I'm so happy to have you here. I was on your show, gosh, I guess it was a couple months back now, and I wanted you on my show so that we can continue the conversation. There's so many similarities between you and I in terms of our philosophies around exercise and training and the way that we eat and muscle mass and how we sort of navigate just life, exercise and life through, you know, through the arc of a woman's life.
Cool. How's Love it.
All right. So I want to start off with a juicy one and try not to roll your eyes because I know that you get this question, as I do a lot as well. Do you think it's possible to build muscle and lose fat simultaneously?
Yeah, I'll keep my eyes firmly forward.
Yeah.
It's funny. The longer you are in any industry, I suppose, the more jaded you can get. But okay, so the answer that I like to give, which will maybe irritate some people, is why do you want to do it that way? Technically, you can. Some people can. Theoretically, you can. But there are many more efficient ways to go about it, which generally I would say, again, if we're doing kind of high level answering this question, would involve sort of a cyclical approach where you're focusing on one more than the other over the course of a year, you know, because it just seems like in whether you're talking about muscle growth or fat loss or literally anything else that you want to accomplish in life, you tend to do a better job, enjoy it more, and do it more effectively and efficiently when you're focusing on one thing at a time. So I think one of the issues that people run into with this, and women especially, because we hate, generally speaking, to gain size or fat or weight, is we have this sort of black and white thinking where if I say, look, it's really hard to gain muscle and lose fat at the same time, so let's just focus on one over the other, people interpret that as saying, okay, I've got to gain a ton of weight to gain muscle. And that makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah, I'm going to become morbidly obese.
I'm going to get huge. Yeah, I'm going to get bulky. Yeah, I'm going to look or feel uncomfortable. That is not necessary. That does not have to be the case. That can happen with some people if they aren't sort of tracking or paying proper attention to the things that they're doing. So, and of course, it also depends too on the individual. Do you have a significant amount of maybe body fat to lose? Maybe in that particular instance, it might be easier for you to build muscle and lose fat at the same time. If you're sort of within a few-ish pounds of your ideal body weight, then it's not going to be the most effective use of your time to try to be doing two things simultaneously. Spend 3, 4, 6 months in a muscle building phase where you prioritize that, and then spend maybe 3 months in a fat loss phase where you prioritize that, and you can kind of cycle in and out. And it doesn't have to be a hugely stark difference in how you're eating or exercising, but it's just about being mindful of what you're trying to do and prioritizing appropriately, I think.
I love this answer so much, and I'm so glad that this is where we started, because I think as much as we say, oh, women are really great multitaskers, like we're just, everybody is generally terrible at it. You know, if you're going to, you're going out hunting and you want to shoot two rabbits, like the likelihood of you going after one at a time, you're likely going to catch the rabbit versus trying to chase them simultaneously and you know, get them both at the same time. So I think that that's a good analog or parallel, let's say, for what we're talking about here. And I think people do, as women especially, and we have to, you know, we have to sort of love our women and meet them where they are, because a lot of women who are very new to lifting weights are very scared about, you know, when they hear the word bulk, you know, it's like it's just one letter away from Hulk, and it's just, you know, you're just going to think like you're like going that. To turn into
See,
this.
See, that's a selling point for me, but not everybody. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, I know. And me too. I'm like, do you know what I would do to like look like She-Hulk, like the Hulk? Like, you know, I would, and I've been working at it for decades and still hasn't happened yet. So love that. Okay. So with that vein with bulking and hulking, lifting heavy. Mm-hmm. I was talking to my podcast producer. She had sent me a couple of reels. She's in menopause. And she was saying to me, look what these people are promoting. It's like, you know, the pink it and shrink it, right? It's like these, like, let's just do like 30,000 little arm rotations. Let's do like 2-pound dumbbells that happen to be pink. And so when we have women who are maybe, you know, in perimenopause and menopause, this is my community, as you know, who have grown up as I have in this sort of cardio bunny, you know, healthy is really what was code word for mm-hmm. skinny, you know, so maybe they're new to weights, let's say. How do they determine what lift, if there's like, okay, I'm going to listen to Ashley, I'm going to listen to Dr. Steph, and I'm going to go into the gym, and I'm going to go where all the bros are, and I'm going to lift some heavy weights. What does heavy weight mean?
I mean, we could talk about this like the entire episode.
Well, I got no more questions after this.
we're just done. Well. Yeah. I mean, I think, so I guess the first place I would start would be perceived exertion. So there is some nuance and some subjectivity to all of this, whether we're talking healthy eating, heavy lifting, whatever. It's not black and white, one correct answer for everybody. So you can't say lifting heavy is you got to be shoulder pressing 45-pound dumbbells. That's not applicable to everybody, right? What we want to focus on is muscle tension and perceived exertion. So if it's hard for you, it's probably heavy. It may not be heavy to somebody else, or maybe what you're lifting is incredibly heavy to one friend and lightweight to another, right? What we want to do is we want to avoid going into the gym and wasting that precious hour of our day that, you know, we don't always get. It's really precious, important time that we're investing in ourselves. We don't want to waste it by kind of sitting around and letting our mind wander while we flop some weights around and don't really feel much. So some people don't like to go into the gym and lift 2 times their body weight in a deadlift. And so you don't have to do that either. I'm not here to, I don't know if I can swear, I'm not here to
go for
shit
it.
On Pilates or powerlifting. If you like one or the other, we can work within kind of any parameter, but you have to be working hard. You have to be challenging the muscle. And too often I see the stereotype again from just like you, decades in the gym, I see guys tend to overestimate what they can lift and then like half rep something that could crush their spine. And women tend to be in there underestimating what they can lift and kind of sitting there looking bored while they're shoulder pressing or tricep pull down or whatever. And I think people, maybe you're afraid of getting bulky. People are also afraid of injury, which is a very valid thing. So you start conservative and you pay attention to your perceived exertion. You pay attention to if your programming, for example, is telling you to do 3 sets of 10 reps of something and your 10th rep kind of feels like your first rep, the weight's too light. If you can barely do 3 reps with proper form, that weight's too heavy. There's somewhere kind of in the middle where you're exerting yourself, you're focusing on it, you're paying attention. You can't be kind of thinking about your grocery list or what you have to do next. You are focused on what you're doing. You're feeling the burn. You're feeling the work. You can still do it safely and appropriately. That's the sweet spot. And you need to kind of play within that. And of course, there's also someone's training age that you want to take into account. So training age is how experienced they are in the gym. If you're brand new, you don't want to be pushing people to do really heavy overhead barbell presses. You want to focus maybe you focus on machines first. Maybe you make sure that person has a spotter. We don't want to injure people and we don't want to make people feel intimidated. But I think that women could probably really benefit both physically and also confidence-wise from going in there and pushing themselves a little bit and going outside of their comfort zone and kind of really getting more comfortable with what it feels like to really work hard when they're lifting. That's sort of an all over the place answer, but it's kind of a start, I guess, to how I feel about it.
Yeah, beautifully said. I think RPE is what you're describing here. So this rate of perceived exertion, I will often counsel people to think about, you know, this is on a scale of, let's say, 1 to 10, with, you know, 10 being childbirth and 1 being like, you know, you're walking down the street and you sort of want to be hitting it somewhere between 8 to 10, you know, maybe 7, 8, 9, 10 out of 10. And that's really where, and that's going to change as well. Like to your point around training age, you know, where you start, you know, as you're building strength, as you're, as the muscle is growing, let's say you're doing, just for sake of ease, we're going to talk about bicep curls. So let's say you're curling 5 pounds, let's say, when you first start, you should be progressing. You should not stay at 5 pounds. So as your strength and the muscle size increases, you can recruit more fiber. You have more of that neuromuscular connection to the muscle. That number is going to change. So you shouldn't stay at 5 or 10 or wherever you start as well, which I think is important. I wanted to actually just double click on time under tension. I think that this is such an important concept that, I mean, I love what you just said about men tend to overestimate and women tend to underestimate. I just saw an example of this morning. I was at the gym, it was leg day, and a guy was trying to, he was trying to bicep curl. Oh God, what was the weight? It doesn't even matter what it was. It was like 75 or 80 pounds. Yeah, it was too much. And literally his range of motion was like 3 degrees of elbow flexion. Like he could not move the weight. But I want to talk about time under tension, because one of the things that I think I see, I used to be also guilty of this as well. So calling myself out here, is I would rush through the reps. So 10 reps, and I would just like 1, 2, 3, you know, rather than actually thinking, about getting my mind in the muscle and thinking about the contraction. So as the muscle is getting, if we're talking about biceps, to continue that example, as the bicep muscle is shortening, and then once I can no longer feel the bicep shortening on that eccentric or the descent, right? So the eccentric contraction, thinking about that. Talk to me a little bit about how we can manipulate time under tension as a factor or vertical in progressive overload.
Yeah, I mean it's such a good question. It's such a good topic, and it's so great when you learn about the concept of time under tension, because as you just said, it's another factor, another piece of the puzzle that can help us build muscle without necessarily upping the weight. And I think, you know, going back to your observation today, like so much of this is about ego, and we could talk about gender differences all the time and how great it would be if maybe women could borrow just a little bit of that stereotypical male self-esteem, and maybe if men could borrow just a little bit of that common sense and we could meld together the perfect mind. But I think, you know, if you take the ego out of the number, I should be lifting this much. I watched this video of this super amazingly fit, jacked chick, and she lifted this, and that's what I want to lift, and I'm not even close. We can take the ego out of it and say, it does not matter what the weight is. It matters the time under tension, the muscle contraction, the effectiveness of the movement. And similar to your point, I'm going to call myself out too, being a meathead for so long. This is a relatively newer concept for me too. And it has come with, I think, a bit of wisdom and a bit of an ego shift, where maybe even 5 years ago, certainly 10 years ago, I really cared that people were impressed by what I did in the gym. Like I was trying to be strong and fit and lift heavy weights. Now I care more about getting a good workout, making the best of my time, and being strong and functionally fit. And, you know, if you want to be smug about it, there are people out there who are probably lifting less weight than you in the gym, but could very well be stronger because they're doing it in a more effective way by using things like time under tension. So I think that's just a really important thing to consider. And, you know, if you are somebody who feels relatively comfortable, this is a whole other topic, but filming yourself doing a movement, not saying you have to set up a tripod in the gym. I'm just saying that these are the things that you don't necessarily notice when I am trying to do a tempoed lift. So again, I love the bicep curl example because I love a bicep curl, but even like squats, for example, if you're trying to do like a 3 second descent, maybe a 1 second pause at the bottom and then 2 seconds up or something, and you think you're doing it, and then you record yourself and you're like, I'm just going through this as quickly as I possibly can, because time slows when you've got a weight on your back, right?
Or you can see the way that you change the movement pattern. Like when you're getting like the squats, we're going to talk about squats because they're the bane of my existence, and I will master them. There's so much going on in a squat, but for like, let's use that example. So we have the 3 tempo descent. Sometimes if you are not filming yourself, you will start seeing maybe your chest falling forward too quickly, or maybe your knees stop flexing, you know, as you're coming down. And then all that's happening is you're sort of shifting the weight either posteriorly or your pelvis is starting to tilt in a way that, you know, is going to take the tension off the glutes, et cetera, et cetera. There's so many ways that a squat can go wrong. I love the idea of videotaping. Yeah. Like, yeah, and maybe it is a tripod. Like if you're by yourself, like I have the benefit of having an Insta husband who I'll be like,
I need you to film me doing this.
I
have the opposite of that.
Well, I because I want to see how I've done. And for squatting, for the longest time, my knees would stop flexing at a certain point. And then it was only once I started filming, I was like, oh my God, I got to work a little bit on my foot mechanics, my ankle mobility. And why is my knee stopping? Right at about 90, my knee stops flexing. But I would never have that feedback. Even though I might have been squatting in front of a mirror, you still don't have the 90 degree. You don't have the side, like the lateral angle. So I love that you brought up videotaping because it does, it can seem a little self
and I'm just uncomfortable. Like I don't want people like looking at me in the gym. And I know if I set up a camera, I'm like inviting people to be like, oh, what's she doing? You know, but if you're doing it for reasons that are helpful to you. And I mean, again, I've done this even recently. Like I'm counting in my head, 1, 2, 3. And I look at the video and it's 1, 2, 3. It's really fast because again, it's just, it's harder in real time. Like what's going on in your head is not always what's actually physically happening. So yeah, but going back to the time under tension, I think you were talking about concentric and eccentric. I think another area that people can really focus on that will really help if we're just looking at muscle contraction and that the amount of time that your muscle is contracting and how that benefits muscle growth and hypertrophy. Think about contracting your muscles during both the concentric and eccentric part of the movement, because again, going back to bicep curls, that's a really easy one. We think about contracting that muscle as we're lifting the weight up, and then we just drop it back down. Can you think about contracting your muscles when you're lowering the weight too? That's adding time under tension. I guarantee you that makes a bicep curl way more difficult to do. I think bicep curls are a really good sample example exercise to test some of these things because it's a quote unquote relatively simple movement. That is, you know, it's a very isolating exercise. So you can use like a lighter weight and you can really think about it. You can really look at yourself in the mirror or really look at the video that you're taking and really spend some time with it and think about the difference between swinging your arm up and down 10 times and thinking, I am doing this movement to contract my bicep as hard as I possibly can during this movement. I want to slow it down to a 4-second concentric and a 4-second eccentric instead of just up, down. And I want to feel how that feels over 10 reps. It's really incredible the difference. And it just goes back to, again, if you're investing this time in yourself, if you're taking this really, really precious time out of your busy life to go and work out, let's, again, get rid of the ego, get rid of the comparison, get rid of what other people are doing and think about how can I challenge the muscle the most effectively in the time that I'm here. And time under tension is a really, really excellent, it's an excellent sort of addition to think about. And also, if you're somebody who's newer and you are a little unsure about weight, if you're thinking like, I'm really not sure about the weight yet, I'm not really sure about what, you know, exertion or, you know, the perceived exertion thing or the reps in reserve, how many reps I could do. Like if you're not really sure about that stuff yet, just slowing down the movement can really, really help increase the difficulty factor without kind of making any other changes.
I love that. I think for, you know, continuing with the bicep, and I'll throw in shoulders here because I was actually recently called out by a guy and I was so thankful for it because I was doing front raises with dumbbells and I could lift the dumbbell. I could lift it up to parallel, no higher, and then the weight would drop. Right. And he just came up to me like this big, brawn, like, you know, we always like say, oh, bros, eye roll. But this guy was like the biggest guy in the gym, but probably the biggest teddy bear in the gym as well, too. He came up to me just out of nowhere and he said, can you lift that weight higher than your shoulder? Like out of nowhere. And I was like, no. And he was like, all right, let me see it. So I did a rep and it was, you know, he saw that and he said, you're also dropping the weight too quickly, which means you can't control the weight. So I said, oh, okay. So I was doing, I can't remember what the number was. Let's just say 20 pounds. I forget the number. So I dropped it down to 15. Yep. And all of a sudden, it was like full range of motion. Like I could get that front delt raise. I could get it all the way up. So like arm right at my ear and then all the way back down with control. So that was, you know, a moment of learning for me where I said, oh yeah, to your point, the eccentric also matters. So if you can get it up on the concentric and then you just drop it as I was doing with that front raise, let's say, that's also an indication that you're, you know, that maybe you either need to drop, like strip the weight, drop the ego. You can totally do that as well. And then you'll, and I know that I'll eventually get back to whatever that weight was. Let's call it 20 pounds. And I'll be able to bring that, you know, be able to bring that shoulder raise all the way up.
Yeah. And I mean, at the very least, you're kind of just wasting half the movement, right? Like you could be getting more out of it. So why not?
Right. Yeah. Right. Let's actually talk about full range versus partial reps. I know that there's a lot of conversation around the validity of both. I know that there's people in the space, you know, sometimes like witnessing the guy this morning, you know, literally doing 3 degrees of elbow flexion with the bicep curl. I was like, all right, guy, like you probably need to drop it a little bit. And I do see the value in partial reps. Yep. Like there are some times where I will... This morning, I was doing partial rep squats. I was doing like 30 or 35 reps. So it's like higher volume. And I'm trying to sort of tire out. I was trying to hit like the upper glutes in this squat that I was doing. So what do you think about full range of motion? Is that sort of the template? Usually, what do you think of partial reps? Give me the goods.
So this is another area that, similar to you, I think I've kind of evolved as I've learned more. And maybe in my younger years, I would have said like full ROM or no rep. Get out of here. Come back to me when you can do like a pull up with a lockout at the end, you know, and I still am kind of, I'm still a little bit of a stickler with pull ups. But anyway, now my response would be, and this is something, this is probably like the biggest thing I deal with my clients in my like health coaching practice is let's talk about what the purpose of this is. Why? What are you doing this for? And in many cases, people are doing half reps or not a full range of motion because they want to do a heavier weight for their ego, or because maybe they have mobility issues, in which case that could be a valid reason, or that could be an indication that you need to work on mobility. There's two aspects there. In many cases, partial rep stuff is something that is done for maybe some hypertrophy, some like extra pump, some higher rep stuff that is sort of has a place in the programming as well as full range stuff. I don't think that we should be maybe focusing, erring on the side of partial rep. I think that that sort of is a tool and it's a place, but a lot of it goes back to what's the purpose. And if you're doing really not great range of motion just because you want to be able to do 15 pull-ups instead of 5, that's not a good reason. Maybe if you have some mobility issues that you're actively working on and you kind of just can't do that full lockout, okay, well then we'll work around that and we'll work on some other things too. So I guess the short answer is I think there's a place for both. I think in most cases, we should all be kind of working for the ability to do a full range. And just another kind of caveat I'd put there too is that, and this is especially, I think, good for women to learn, and I talk about this a little bit in some of the courses and the programming that I've created, is that full range of motion is also going to look different on different bodies. And you mentioned squatting. I'd be interested to hear why that's sort of like a challenge for you, if maybe some of it has to do with body mechanics or even just like physiology and like skeletal makeup, right?
That's what I think it is. My femurs are long. Yeah. My femurs are long. So I have a harder time staying upright. I feel there's a point in the squat where I'm locked. Like I can't actually go any further unless I start to flex. Like there's more hip flex. So I'm dropping the chest so I can initiate a bit more hip flexion.
100%. So that's going to be a thing. So if people have in relation to their torso and their legs, if they've got a longer torso and shorter legs, powerlifting, Olympic lifting body, if they've got like longer legs and a shorter torso, you're going to have a harder time with some movements, and not even necessarily always a harder time, but maybe your setup's going to look a little different. Maybe the execution is going to look a little different.
Yeah.
So in many cases, you know, I have, my husband is 6'3" with like the longest arms I've ever seen on a human, super long legs. His squat is always going to look very different than mine. I'm 5'4". I've got relatively short limbs. Our bodies are going to do the same movement in different ways, and that's okay. So again, to compare yourself to whatever influencer or generally male, because in many cases, and I'm sure you were probably the same way, I grew up watching videos, watching professionals, watching bodybuilders, even now, like the big bodybuilding podcasts, they're all men talking about men with male bodies. So we can't always sort of compare that way. We need to think about what range of motion feels good, is targeting, again, the muscles you're looking to do. Like if you're trying to do a quad dominant squat and your lower back always hurts when you're squatting, okay, there's a problem here. There's a problem with the setup. There's a problem with the weight. There's a problem somewhere, right? So
yeah, your pelvis is tilting the wrong way when you're doing
that. And our skeletons, women's skeletons are shaped differently. We do have a different angle from our hips to our knees because of our wider hips. And so our femurs are going to be kind of it angling in more, which is going to affect our setup for a lot of things, for things like even like a farmer's carry. This is such a small, tiny detail, but it's stuff that like when you know how your body works, it takes some of the frustration, some of the like judgment, some of the irritation out of it. We just know because of our physiology, things are different. Like our shoulders in relation to our hips are smaller, right? Men often wide shoulders, narrow hips, where we tend to be sort of the opposite. If you're carrying a heavy kettlebell or a suitcase for a farmer's carry, you might be hitting your hips every time you walk, and it's irritating as hell. Men don't generally have that problem. So it's things to think about when you're doing lists. I'm not saying don't do a farmer's carry. I love one. But these are just things to kind of keep in mind. Our bodies are different, and we're going to move and express ourselves differently.
So for all my nerds that are listening, she's describing the Q angle, which is the basically the angle between, or the, you know, sort of follows a quadricep, which is why I think it's called the Q angle. But you're looking for the outer part of the femoral head, and then you're measuring down to the medial part of the the femur. And for women, that Q angle is much more exaggerated. It's like the curviness, right? It's like we tend to be more knock-kneed, you know, which the technical term there is genu valgum. And yeah, it's going to change the mechanics, as you said, of the squat. It's going to change the way that we walk. The farmer's carries. It's the,
so
again,
annoying.
My hips are always brushing against, and I'm like, God damn it. Yeah. Yeah. I love that. That's so great. Okay. So, and so what we're talking, so I love this because this is another way to think about progressive overload is like, how can we have perfect form? Mm-hmm. How can we execute a beautiful squat for our anatomy, for our current movement strategy, understanding what the movement strategy is? Have we developed some compensatory patterns that we need to maybe strip off the weight a little bit or kind of get back to basics? I had to do this with the squat. So I've talked about this on the show before, but every time I hit 185 pounds on a barbell squat, like a, you know, back squat, I would always injure my left knee, like predictably, and then I would have to strip it back, and I would have to do like, then it was 45, it was like 135 for a while, and then I would get, and then it was 150, and then blah, blah, I'd work my way back up to 185, and then I injure the knee again. And part of that was because I was trying to stay upright. I was trying to, so I mentioned to you before, femurs are long, I sort of lock out, and so I was trying to stay upright, and then my knees were kind of just trying to get, like, I was trying to get up out of the squat. So really double down on foot mechanics. I think there's a lot of attention around squatting, particularly with ankle mobility. I agree that ankle mobility is important, and I think that if you focus on the foot where there's like 25% of the, you know, if we think about like, where's the, like, can we major in the majors and not the minors? Like ankle mortise is one joint. There are 25% of the bones in the foot of the body in the foot. I don't know if this is a pet peeve for you. This is a pet peeve for me. When I was taught to squat this way, push up from the heels. Did you ever hear that? Like to activate the squat to push up from the calcaneus or to push up from the heel. It's like, why don't we just use the whole foot that God gave us? Like, why is it just the one bone, the one bone in the foot that we need to be? Like, why not actually think about the whole foot? And so I actually hired a coach to help me with this. He's in the States. He's great. Iron University. Shout out to Aldo Paredes, I believe is his last name. And so I went to his gym in Miami, and you know, completely changed the way that I lunge, completely changed the way that I squat, really talked me about foot activation. And of course, as a chiropractor, I already knew it, but sometimes you just need, you just need someone to remind you like, hey, you also have like this other appendix, you know, this other appendage on your body that you can use to activate your glutes, like your feet. So I thought that it was so, and this is why I'm saying like, whether it doesn't matter what your certifications are, the letters behind your name, et cetera. Find your, like, all the good coaches have coaches. Like, you also need a coach
Absolutely.
As well.
Absolutely. And I love what you said about majoring in the majors, because this is another thing that I actually have always been about this, and even more so now as I am older, as I am a parent, as my priorities with training and lifting have changed. It's increasingly important for me, and this is something I pass along to my clients, to focus on foundational movements, foundational lifestyle habits, practices, majoring in the things that really matter, because it's such a human tendency to be like, yeah, but what about this like shiny little thing over here that I can try that's supposed to do X, Y, Z? And it's like,
what about 75 hard? Should I be doing that?
Oh my goodness. But like, even, you know, I just posted something on Instagram the other day, this amazing, I don't know, fitness trainer who's like an influencer online, but he posts these funny reels about like when your trainer's just like making stuff up off the fly. And it's these like exercises that are just ridiculous. It's just plyometric with weird, just overly complicated.
Running full speed on the treadmill, someone's throwing something at you and then you have to hop over it.
100%. And it's just stuff that makes you feel like you're doing something, but to what end? And can we just focus? And even like, you know, there are people, there's a subset of the population that can really use and benefit from these very hyper-specific, tweaked, weird workouts or even supplements or protocols or whatever. But 99.9% of us are going to find the vast majority of benefit from doing the boring, basic, foundational stuff consistently and well. And that's one of the biggest barriers to people achieving their goals, is they do not want, to be completely honest, they do not want to put the attention consistently over enough time to these boring foundational things. And the unsecret secret of the industry is that that is what people do to be healthy and fit and strong and look good. And then maybe they talk about or sell some other fancy thing because it's eye-catching and it's sexy and it's fun. But at the end of the day, people are not getting fit and healthy and you know, just overall wellness from that little fancy, sexy, weird thing over here. They're doing it from sleep and movement and strength training and eating properly. And so I love when someone like you underscores that, because I often find, even when I'm talking on my podcast or when I'm working with my clients, that I feel this sense of sometimes maybe either boredom or disappointment, where it's like, really? Like, that's all you have to say? You just have to do this stuff? Like, just this kind of workout and this kind of food? And it's like, it's the truth. It may be disappointing, but that's what it does. You know, I'm not trying to sell you some weird, fancy trick, because there aren't any, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, it's the surrender to the monotony. Yeah. You know, John Goodman, who I know you know, we'll talk about like same squat, different shirt, you know? It's like you just do the same thing. It's the same thing. There are no, it's like the, you know, the squat, the deadlift, the pull-up, like there are some, I think that there's some sort of bait, as you mentioned, foundational movement patterns that we all should master.
One of my foundational skin practices is daily red light therapy directly on my face. Red light therapy direct to the face will help reduce the appearance of fine lines and wrinkles, scars, blemishes, and it will promote a firmer, more youthful looking skin. I use the Bond Charge face mask every morning for about 20 minutes while I'm checking my morning emails and starting my workday. The mask is equipped with the most optimal wavelengths of red light at 630 nanometers and infrared light at 850 nanometers. Using red light therapy regularly on the face will help to reduce the appearance of scars and blemishes, redness, and fine lines and wrinkles. So if you are wanting glowing, younger, firmer looking skin this year with minimal effort or time without really changing your usual day or night routine, head over to bondcharge.com/better and use the discount code better at checkout. And that gives you 15% off your entire cart. But if you're looking to change the appearance of your skin, go for the face mask. I promise you will not be disappointed.
What are some of the foundational movement patterns that you deem necessary that people master?
Movement patterns. I mean, again, super boring. Now everyone who's listening can roll their eyes, like walk a lot. Movement, you know, that's some good foot strength. That's some great sort of lower body joint strength and core strength. If you want to make it hard, walk in hilly, difficult places. Put a weight on your back if you want to, but that kind of movement, I mean, people are walking 500 steps a day and then going and beasting themselves with a 90-minute CrossFit workout. It's like, we should be switching this. We should be moving all day long and then going in and doing an effective hard workout for 45 minutes or an hour. In terms of like movements in the gym, again, it's like, well, what I would do if I could only do a couple movements for the rest of my life, it would be squats, some variation of a squat, lunges, push-ups, pull-ups, some kind of overhead pressing, some kind of upper body pressing. That's basically it. that's all. I mean, of course, you know, you can get into the weeds on like RDLs and single leg stuff and unilateral training, which I think is also very important. But yeah, if you can do, if and as a grown woman, if you can do a decent amount of proper push-ups, if you can do a couple pull-ups, if you can do an effective strong squat with your body weight, you know, those are impressive, important, functional movements.
Yeah. Love that. Yeah, I agree. We used to, in the clinic, I used to do very similar. These were the sort of initial, when I had patients coming in, we do an initial assessment of them. A wall sit was one of them. Push-up was one of them. So I would ask them to do a push-up on their toes to see how many they could do. Most women fit, they could either do one or, you know, they would punch out one, but it wasn't a push-up. It was just, there was so much bowing and so much distortion in the upper body. We would also do, we would look at grip strength. I would see if they could, we had a sort of a rehab space. So I would go into the back and see if they could do any type of pull-up, whether it was a scapular pull-up, full pull-up. Most women, it was a no. And then squat mechanics, balance, proprioception, that kind of thing. Yeah. Let's talk about injury. You mentioned, and this is something that I've always paid attention to because it was the bread and butter of my practice for, you know, 16 years. People would come in from, I don't mean to call out any one thing, but CrossFit, you know.
Was just call it out.
It just, you know, I love it for the community. I love that it gets people moving. And I think that the as many as you can in the, let's say, whatever the WOD is, we tend to sacrifice form for quantity. It's like we tend to sacrifice quality for quantity. And I would always joke, like my practice was not too far from a CrossFit gym. And I was like, that was
great unintentional,
one of the best. Yeah, it was a great business move. Because I would always have injured people coming in with like hernias and, you know, ligament, like shoulder issues up the wazoo. Yeah. Anyway, so let's talk about injury because I'm in my 40s now, and I talk a lot, as you know, perimenopause and menopause. This is a crucial time for at least maintaining the muscle tissue that you have and the bone density that you have and the ligamentous and joint integrity that you have. But ideally, with the science and with how our understanding of muscle tissue and the skeletal system or the skeletal system, depending on what area of the world you're from. Someone actually complained that I say skeletal.
Is that Canadian, like, do you think? Right. What is that?
I don't know. That's how my teacher said it. It was like the neuromusculoskeletal system. So that's just how, because my teachers would say it
tomato,
like that.
Tomato, tomato.
Okay. So musculoskeletal system. Maybe that's, I don't know if that's American or whatever. So we know that this is important to maintain, ideally add on to as our sex hormones are in flux during that time. And there's a rapid change that we know that happens at menopause or leading up to menopause. The one thing that I have been trying to educate my community on more and more is this idea. And this is why I started off with form and full range versus partial, because we cannot afford to be injured in our 40s and 50s the way that we can in our 20s and 30s. Like, you can kind of be stupid in your 20s and 30s. The ego can get involved, as it was involved with me for many years. But now in my 40s, I have to be relatively stringent with my form, because taking me out of the gym now is far more deleterious to the impact that it's going to have on my body composition, on my hormones, on my mood, on my affect, on my sleep, all the things, than it might have in my 20s. So I wanted to talk a little bit about injury prevention. I have a couple of questions, but first I wanted to, like, do you have the same opinion? What is your thinking around injury prevention in general? And then we can kind of get into some of the specifics.
Well, it's funny because as you were talking, I'm thinking, I 100% agree with this. And there's a reason why, you know, people in their 20s, there's a reason why sort of the life's journey happens the way it does. Like, you kind of are off on your own, making your own dumb mistakes while you're young and resilient enough to deal with it. But as you were talking, I'm like, you know what? I actually kind of want to challenge this a little bit, because just because you're young and supple and can bounce back faster doesn't mean that we should be maybe as reckless as we are. And we kind of make light of, like, yeah, go be dumb and like do CrossFit till you're dead in your 20s and then we'll fix it later. Because a lot of my clients, a lot of my friends, a lot of people in my community are still dealing with injuries they got when they were younger, are detrimentally impacted now in their later 30s, 40s, and beyond because of quote unquote dumb stuff they did when they were young, because they could get away with it.
That they never fixed.
They never fixed. Yeah. And also that may have permanently redirected their lifestyle habits in a way that they're now suffering. So, I a very common story that I have, and this is not about calling people out or judging people. It's common. So don't, if you hear yourself in this, don't feel like you're dumb. Feel like you're part of a very large group of people.
Having a human
exactly.
experience.
Exactly. Yeah. But, somebody who maybe we use CrossFit, or maybe people who did a lot of like endurance running or like long distance running or something. And so then they injured their knee or injured their hip or something. And then in your 30s, which is a period of time when a lot of people are progressing in their career, having kids, doing things like that, and oftentimes prioritizing maybe their fitness less, they go through maybe a decade where they're like, I used to work out all the time and fitness was my identity and I was did all this and I did all that and then I was injured and then I stopped. And now maybe I'm 40 and I'm feeling a little bit better and I want to get back into it and I feel completely lost, like I'm starting all over again. Instead of like sort of a secondary path they could have taken, where if the programming and the decision making was a little bit more intelligent when they were younger and they weren't beasting themselves because they could, because they were 25, maybe they could have kept going doing the sport they love this entire time. And they're enjoying lots of muscle mass and lots of energy and good functional movement because they didn't beat themselves into the ground. And, I have definitely had a couple stupid injuries in my younger years. So I'm not saying I'm totally free of this, but I will say that one of the things that I think has kept me able to kind of maintain a consistent fitness throughout my 30s, and now I'm I have a big birthday, I have the big 40 coming up very soon, has been because I never let myself get to the point where I was overtraining, under recovering, under nourishing, and experiencing that very, very common roadblock that a lot of people do, where they just push too hard for the sake of pushing too hard, and they find themselves with injuries that don't seem catastrophic at the time, and then a decade, 2 decades later, they're still dealing with it, right? So I would argue, if you're listening and you are still young and in shape, be smart. Don't wait to make your own mistakes in this particular instance. Be smart and protect yourself now so that you don't have to deal with it later on when it's harder, you know?
Yeah, and thank God for my chiropractors, because I have been under regular care for like the better part of maybe working on 30 years now. That's how I actually became a chiropractor, was I was a patient first. And the other thing I'll add, just as a clinic, this is just my observation in clinic, is that individual who's pushing themselves so much in the gym is going to go to the chiropractor or the physical therapist or the like some body worker, and they're going to go until they see some symptom resolution. And then they're going to stop. And then they're going to go back into the gym, and then they're going to re-injure themselves. So they don't actually, they just sort of wait until the pain is subclinical. So they'll wait until the acute pain is gone. I'm like, I feel better. Great. All right, we're done here. And then we're going to go on. So if it is, and I know that this is not available to everybody. So I recognize when as I hear myself saying this, I'm very lucky to have grown up in the chiropractic community where there was always someone that's like, hey, can I use your spine as like a testing ground for whatever Gonstead technique or whatever technique we were learning. So I'm blessed in that way. I mean, I guess it's also a blessing and a curse, because if you're the guinea pig spine, then, you could certainly create some injuries there too. But I'll say that sticking with regular care of some sort, whether it's a regular adjustment, a regular visit to your massage therapist. I mean, these are things that I do. I'm regularly in my, and I have friends that I pay for. I do not say, hey, I know we're friends and just like, we'll just swap. I pay for the adjustment. I pay for the massage therapy. I pay for all the things because I do believe in their value. So just a little piece there is don't just stop care when it's subclinical. Actually reverse the movement mechanics, and working with the chiropractor or the physio or the, whoever it is, the occupational, whatever it is, the osteopath, I should say, they're really going to help out there. Okay, great. What do you think about if you are injured? So for me, I would never stop working out. And maybe this is, you're going to call me a tool, but I would never stop working out. I would just modify the workout, right? So let's say I injured myself on the squat. I'm like, all right, so instead of going to the barbell today, I am going to go to the, maybe I'll do the hamstring, lying hamstring curl. I'll do quad extensions. I'll do some glute, like I'll do the abduction machine, or I'll do the glute machine. So I'm getting all the muscles that were activated in the squat, but I'm not necessarily doing the squat because I never wanted to have the time off or lose any progress that I had made. Do you agree with that, or am I an idiot?
You're You're an idiot, Stephanie. No. I absolutely think that you should continue training. I think this is where a lot of common sense comes in. This is where a lot of ego checking comes in. It can be very difficult for people who are used to training a certain way to not be able to train that way. But look at professional athletes, for example. Let's look at football. Football's on right now, and so that's very timely. And people are always getting injured in football. And these are like catastrophic ACL, Achilles injuries and broken ankles and stuff. Are they stopped, like completely not working out? No, of course, they're doing tons of physio and tons of rehab and tons of exercise. Is it hard and difficult and mentally challenging to like hardly do anything when you're used to being an elite athlete? Yes, but that's where the consistency of your health habits and what matters to you. Does it matter to you that you can just go in and show off and like lift heavy? Is that what matters to you? Then yeah, this will really suck if you can't do that. But does it matter that you're being healthy and functional and protecting this very important muscle for your health? Then yes, you can go in and continue to do all kinds of things. The common sense factor is like, is what you're doing hurting you? Does it hurt the injury? Stop doing it, okay? Because there's always an alternative exercise. There's always other things you can do. There's actually, I should see if I can find this, because there is like actual research you may have come across too that shows when people are injured, like if you injure your left shoulder and you continue to kind of do full body workouts and work the other arm, like the muscle on that injured side is protected. So you don't even have to do as much as you think you have to do. Like if your left delt is injured, speaking from experience, you don't have to keep gritting through shoulder presses to protect that muscle. You can do some other sort of accessory work, nearby work, even work the other arm, don't go crazy, whatever, but keep the blood flowing, keep the consistent routine going. It's good for your mental health. It's good for your physical health. It's going to help the rehab. It's going to help the other physio things that you're doing, help you sort of improve and heal faster. So yes, absolutely keep doing that. Ideally, to your point earlier, work with a coach or someone who is intelligent and experienced and knowledgeable about this kind of stuff to help with some programming so that you aren't going in and either wasting your time or hurting yourself. But yeah, you absolutely should do it. And I think one of the biggest benefits is going to be sort of the mental resilience that it takes to work through injury and to be consistent and to take care of your health instead of just do the stuff in the gym you like to do, you know?
Yeah. And I would say that, you know, to your point, the prognosis of the patient, the quicker that we're able to start replicating, at least activating some of the muscles, maybe in a different way, or at least the movement pattern so that we can correct the movement pattern. So I would have a lot of ankle, I would see a lot of ankle injuries. So the quicker that I could get them toe tapping, doing some heel raises so that we can kind of challenge it was usually the lateral, you know, lateral side of, you know, you sort of sprain the foot, usually rolling on the outside. So when we could get, the quicker we could get them to calf raises, eyes open, eyes closed, all the stuff, the better their prognosis tended to be versus like resting it and not doing anything until they felt like they were ready to come back. So I agree with you on that. The other thing that I really like for injuries is blood flow restriction. I don't know if you've ever played around with that, but I find that to be wonderful. Yeah. Shoulder injuries in particular, it's, you know, if you can wrap it around the, you know, wrap the blood flow restriction around the sort of just around like the top of the or base of the shoulder, I guess you could say, base of the deltoid. I found that to be very effective for, again, like pushing the blood and pushing all the sort of the healing nutrients that we're trying to do into the joint that we're looking
at. I haven't done that as much as maybe I should, considering I do have my own sort of nagging ongoing shoulder thing. I have played with it a little bit and I have heard some really good things, but it's an area that I actually probably should be exploring more.
It feels awful. Mm. So I'll just preface it by saying it is one of the more, I have the KATSU bands. So KAATSU, I believe is how it's, and they have this cyclical feature on it. So you wrap the band around the arm and then it sort of inflates. So it sort of cuts off the blood flow and then it relaxes, inflates. So I actually really like that because you're sort of it's a pulsatile program that helps to drive the blood flow into the area. And again, when we're talking about injury, like as a rehab tool, it's wonderful. As a prehab tool, it's wonderful. And even just if you wear it, sometimes I'll just sort of wear it as I'm doing housework and my hands, you know, like you really like the whole, like it, you get that sort of post-workout pump in the arm. It's really nice. So
okay, I might have to look into that. Information.
Yeah. Yeah. It's really cool. You mentioned undernourishing. So we were talking about injuries and you said, hey, if you're undernourished, you know, probably, and I would probably say that most females, even at the athletic level, are going to be in sort of this low energy availability, like they're not eating enough. So I wanted to maybe transition a little bit from working out in the gym, because I know another area that you and I both really love to geek out on is nutrition. What are some of the consequences, short, like acutely, and then over a longer delta, of undernourishing, under eating? And I'm talking to the women who are listening that think that 1200 calories or even 1500 calories is an appropriate caloric intake as sort of maintenance. Mm-hmm.
There are so many consequences, and it's probably got to be the biggest challenge and focus of my work, honestly, period, is to get women eating more food. And, you know, being in this industry and the kind of bubble that we can be in, it can seem silly or unrealistic, or like I'm kind of preaching into a vacuum to say things like women should be eating more than 1200, 1500 calories, or you won't get bulky if you lift weights. But then when I speak to the general population, when I speak to clients who are coming to me who haven't maybe been in this world for so long, and that is still the narrative of, well, you can get away with, you know, you can get away with 1200, 1300 calories. I've been doing it for 10 years, you know, or you know, I don't want to lift because I saw this one CrossFitter who was super jacked and I don't want to look like that because that's going to happen to us all, right? Anyway, these things are...
One can dream.
Anyway, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it is still something that is really, really taught and ingrained. And I have a lot of empathy for women who have been told this because it's such a fear-based rhetoric, right? It's so much about if you get bigger, that's the worst thing that could possibly happen. And that's not a challenge or a fear that men have to deal with. You know, we can make the argument that, you know, their sort of similar issue is the opposite side of the coin of being, you know, being worried about being skinny or not being big enough, right? And that's the challenge they have to deal with. But it's a really, really pervasive, overarching thing that eating more, being bigger, taking up space, being large, being a bigger size, weighing more, is the worst possible outcome that could happen. And I could argue with you that having low bone density and getting early onset osteoporosis and sarcopenia and muscle wasting, which is going to have you at a higher risk of injury as you get older, losing your cycle, losing your period, having all kinds of hormonal disruptions, having no energy and mood swings and irritability and brain fog and trouble sleeping and low libido. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I would argue that that whole host of symptoms,
hair loss,
all of these things are much worse than being a larger pant size, actually. And again, it doesn't have to be one or the other, but I think we are focusing our fears in the wrong place. Those are all things that happen when we undernourish. And I've had a couple clients, even just recently, who the biggest win that we've had has been getting them to pay attention to what they're eating, seeing just how little they were eating, especially how little protein. And over a couple of months, raising the protein, raising the calories, and their entire life changing. And this is not an exaggeration. The energy, the focus, the mood, their ability to go and have energy to like actually work hard in the gym. Because that's the other thing. People who are doing this, I want to build muscle but lose fat at the same time, who are also doing way too much in the gym and eating way too little to support that work that they're doing. That's a problem. If you want to put muscle on your body, that means growing tissue. You cannot hope to grow tissue, new tissue on your body, when you are not eating enough to support the daily functions of your body's operation system. And we don't think about that level of it. All we're thinking is, okay, well, if I eat this little, I'm not getting any extra calories. I'm not eating in a surplus. And so then I'm going to go and just bust my ass in the gym and I'm going to see this muscle come. That's not how it works. And especially not for women's bodies. Men can kind of put up with that a little bit better. And some women can too for a certain period of time. But it's just, it's incorrect information to tell women that they can get away with very, very low calories and work for 3 hours in the gym and think that functional, fit, well operating, happy person is going to come out of it. So that's, I mean, even more than lifting weights, even more than working out and finding all that beautiful, empowering strength that comes from it. The very first thing I work with people is like, how much are you eating? What are you eating? Are you eating enough? And let's work on that. So important.
Yeah, because it's something that everybody has to deal with on a day-to-day basis. We all have to figure out what we're eating. So we are always faced with nutrition decisions every single day. And I would say I love everything that you've said. And I think that there's so many, you know, we've been talking a little bit about fitness influencers and, you know, people online and stuff. And one of the things that, you know, when you look at, let's say, fitness competitions or, you know, people who are regular, like just people who are in the fitness industry, for women, about half of them don't have their menstrual cycles. And this is sort of normal. And let me, for the record, say that it is never normal not to have a menstrual cycle. If you don't have a menstrual cycle, it means that you don't have enough body fat. You don't have enough tissue, as you were saying, on the body to sustain the necessary, whether or not you want children, necessary reproductive cycle. And, you know, food is a safety signal. Right? Like, you know, one of the things I was talking to David Rabin on stress and eustress and good stress, bad stress. And we were talking about this idea that one of the cornerstones for female healing in particular is to feel safe. Like, we cannot grow, we cannot flourish if we don't feel safe. And I think that the same actually applies here. You are not going to be anabolic if you don't feel safe. If you don't have food, your body is not going to feel safe. You are not going to be growing any kind of tissue. And if anything, I would say, you know, we mentioned it sort of, I think you mentioned it earlier in our conversation, you know, maybe if you are someone who has a lot of weight to lose, that might be true. But as you get closer to your goal weight, quote unquote, goal weight, and weight, another thing, we're going to talk about weight. I'm just going to shelf that for a moment. But as you get closer to whatever you, you know, whatever your goal is, your body's not dumb. Like, you're not just going to linearly keep losing fat. You're going to start sacrificing other tissue as well. Organ tissue, bone tissue, muscle tissue. So food is absolutely a safety signal. And I love that you talked about protein. Because again, as we age, and we've talked about this on the show, but it's worth reiterating, as we age, that anabolic signal to the muscle, the neuromusculoskeletal system decreases, right? So that ratio of bone building to bone breaking down cells changes. The sensitivity to insulin in the muscle changes. The sensitivity to growth in the muscle changes. So protein, and I'll let you expand on this, in my opinion, is the only macronutrient that actually changes as we age. Like, the requirement of protein actually changes as we age. We need more of it, which is why I don't agree with some of the Blue Zone conclusions and the, you know, and this is actually why I've changed my opinion on fasting. I used to fast a lot, used to talk about fasting quite a bit, and I still think it's a tool not to be completely disregarded, but I think that when we think about applying it for women, we have to be very, very careful that, because my clinical working with clients, women overdo it. I'll tell them, I want you to fast for 12 hours and they fast for 14. If I tell them I want them to fast for 14 hours, they'll fast for 20. You know, so they tend to, it's like more is more is more. And it's not always with the female body.
Yes, 100%. And that, again, that's a very human reaction where you think, like, if this is good, then twice that is better. And if there's a reason why mild caloric restriction is a tool in fat loss, right? It makes sense. But mild is the word here. Moderate caloric restriction over time is better than cutting your calories in half for 6 weeks and trying to get as skinny as possible. That is not a...
And staying there. And never actually changing your caloric intake.
And I mean, again, that is a very, very common thing. And I see it a lot with everybody, where I see it a lot in the fitness industry and the wellness industry too. And I'm sure you know some people in our world who kind of do this too, where they sort of preach something and practice something different because everyone kind of secretly in their head thinks, I'm different. You know, it's like the whole like sleep thing, right? Like, there are a lot of people who are like, look, you need 7 to 9 hours of sleep a day and that's non-negotiable. But secretly, they're burning the candle at both ends and they're waking up at 4 to get their workouts in and all these things. It's like, you're not different. No one is special. You,
as much as you'd like to believe that
we all like to think we're special. And we're special in our own little ways, but not like that. Not like that. We can't get away with starving ourselves and not sleeping and being stressed out and overtraining. Nobody
benefits from that in the long term? Nobody. And to your point, yes, I think that is a very common misconception that as we get older and maybe we're thinking, look, I'm not doing CrossFit every day. I'm not trying to even really build muscle. I'm just trying to maintain what I have. I'm trying to maintain my health. So I guess I could eat less and I can eat less protein. I'm not like beasting myself in the gym every day. But yeah, our bodies, unfortunately, as we age, get a little bit less good at utilizing those amino acids that we're getting from the protein. So we need to work a little harder at that. And that's why protein is always also the most important part of the dietary sort of question when I'm working with people, where I'm like, that is what we need to focus everything around. We can talk about carbs, we can talk about fat, we can talk about protein, we can talk about overall calorie consumption, we can talk about all that stuff, but not until we get this protein piece sorted out. That's the most important thing. And you need to eat probably more of it than you are. And that can be uncomfortable for some people. And sometimes it, similar to the progressive overload thing we were talking about with training, I'm not telling people to go from 50 grams of protein a day to 150 overnight. This takes time and we need to make adjustments based on the individual. But if you're eating less than 100 grams of protein every day, we probably need to work on it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. Let's talk a little bit about weight, because this is, well, do you use the scale as a tool?
I personally do not. Some of my clients do. And again, it's just sort of like a phase of my life that I'm going through. There were certainly, really the only time I ever used the scale was I did go through a period where I was competing in figure competitions and competitive bodybuilding. Mm-hmm. And it was one of many metrics that I was using to judge fat loss and body composition, but I've never really been somebody who paid attention to that. And again, I emphasize with people who were brought up or were taught to really, really highly value a number on the scale. I think it's really, for a lot of people, it's harmful. And even if it isn't harmful, it's just one piece of the puzzle. And this is what I try to tell most people, because a lot of people have a real love-hate relationship with their scale and they're not getting rid of it. And they find some kind of either validation some kind of input feedback. And that's why they're using the scale. But I just try to remind people that it's just one thing. Don't use it as your only or most important marker of progress or improvement or adherence to whatever you're trying to do. There's so many variables, especially with the female body, right? Like, did you have good sleep last night? What did you eat last night? What part of your cycle are you in? You know, did you have a drink? How long ago was leg day? Did you have a bowel movement recently? Like, these things matter. Yeah. And you can, a functioning, perfectly healthy body can, you know, go up and down and weight a few pounds a day. And a few pounds is usually all it takes to have people completely thrown off their game. You know, you think you're this weight, you're 3 pounds more and your whole day's shot, when it means nothing, right? So I tend to not prioritize that. And I think it can be, again, unless you're an athlete in a weight specific sport, it's not that important. It's only one very small piece of the puzzle.
Yeah, I love that you're saying this, because I like, you know, I have a love-hate relationship with the scale, because it does indicate, it is a metric, and I think that there are other metrics that are more useful. Mm-hmm. So what do your measurements look like? Are your jeans fitting a little differently? What is your energy like? You know, what is your appetite? You know, all of these sort of, you know, non-scale, call them, like, you know, they've been sort of dubbed like the non-scale victories. Like, what are those things that are showing up for you that are measurably improving your quality of life that are not necessarily reflected on this? They may be reflected on the scale, but they may not.
Yeah. And different body types and different sports and different times in your life, they all require different weights. And if you're looking at, you know, famous people or your favorite influencer or your friends or anybody online, you have no idea what they weigh based on how they look. I've used this, it's like a dumb, very aesthetic example, but I just feel like it helps people who are really caught up in this like cycle of like what I weigh on the scale. And I think back to when I was competing in bodybuilding and the day before a show, and I take a nice little picture of me at my leanest and I'm all depleted and lean and I have a full six pack. And for some people, that's a great look. Maybe it's not realistic. Maybe it's not attractive to some people, but it's a very lean, quote unquote, fit looking body, right? Mm-hmm. If I post that picture and everybody says, wow, look at all that hard work, you look so good. And at the bottom, I say, I weigh 115 pounds. Or I say, I weigh 140 pounds. Or I say, I weigh 165 pounds. does it change what I look like? Does it change how hard I worked? Does it change all of these other metrics that went into it? It doesn't. It doesn't matter. No one's going to say, well, you know, I looked at that picture and I thought you looked good when you said 115, but now that I know you're 130, like, gross, that's no good. No one's going to say that. No one cares about the weight except for you. Again, unless you're in some sport, you know, weight specific sport or whatever, but it's just, it's such a subjective measurement that people get too caught up over. Yeah, it can be helpful to know I feel really good around 130, and over time, due to stress and poor eating habits, I've worked my way up to 144. It's good to, you know, that can be helpful to kind of know, look, there's some things happening, but do I need to obsess every morning and get on the scale and see that I'm 2 pounds heavier and what did I do wrong yesterday? Like, no, that's not helpful. It's not helping you.
Yeah. I would always counsel women if they want to have the scale as one of their measurements, like do it twice a month.
Yes.
So you do it around ovulation-ish, and then you do it around bleed week-ish, right? So you start like, you know, first day of your period, and then you can do it again in two weeks, and then, you know, and repeat. Because then you can sort of directionally over time see how things are going. To your point, you can have a nice wide range, 14, 15 pounds or whatever, where you're like, I feel good here. And then as I get up higher on that range, then I feel less good. And you can sort of see that, because your weight will fluctuate quite significantly for some over the course of the month, over the course of their menstrual cycle. When you're in perimenopause and your menstrual cycle is all over the place, and you have no idea where you are, it can be even more erratic. So you have no idea where you are. Like, am I follicular right now? Am I luteal? No idea. Yeah. So you could be holding extra water weight and not understand why. And, you know, I sort of tongue in cheek said after leg day, I gain a lot of weight after leg day. Like if I ever weigh myself, like I did legs today, tomorrow I'll be like easily 5 pounds more, because I'm just more inflamed. Like I've just ripped up all the muscle. Like I'm just repairing. That's just how it is. So I think sort of contextually, that's also helpful. And
another sort of very common piece that your listeners may already be like, duh, but it's maybe worth reiterating, is that also, if your goal is to build muscle and have a nice muscular toned fit body, you're going to probably weigh more than someone who maybe fits into the same size clothes as you, but does not have a lot of skeletal muscle, right? So a lot of people, it's like we forcibly push this common sense stuff out of our brains, where we're thinking, look, I did all this work. Look at how much more fit and toned I look. Look at how the shape of my body has changed, but I gained 5 pounds. So I guess this isn't a win. It's like, use your brain here. You gained muscle. You gained tissue. Right. It looks better. You're fitter. But yeah, maybe you weigh a couple more pounds on the scale. Like, what are you going to do?
Yeah. I almost never weigh myself now, I have to be honest, because I just know, I sort of just know my patterns. Like I'm heavier in my luteal phase. I'm heavier after, you know, a poor sleep, as you mentioned, always heavier after a poor sleep, heavier after leg day. And it's like, it's just up and down, easy come, easy go. Like I don't really care about it. I do like to watch measurements over time. And part of it is, you know, I'm kind of in an active, like I would like my shoulder, I would like to grow glutes on my delts. Like I would like to grow... I would like to grow glute size delts.
I want to make a note of that. That's the line of the day. That's so good. You got to clip that one out. That's so good.
I've got to clip. Yeah. All right. So my AV production, I'll make sure. So I want to get broader. Yeah. Like I want to have larger measurements up, you know, in sort of my upper body. Mm-hmm. And then if my glutes are growing, I'm also like, I'm pretty happy with that as well. Yeah.
Okay. I really appreciate that about you, because again, one of the things that I have found hard to find in the women's fitness community, especially with trends being what they are right now, very glute focused, I have always been a shoulder girl myself. And I've even actually, you know, pro tip for people who are looking to have that sort of hourglass figure that they're looking for. You want to look like you have this little tight snatched waist, right? That everybody's like coveting. Guess one great way to do that. Build the shoulders, build the back, do some pull-ups, do some lat pull-downs, do some delt raises. Building this part, getting a nice, big, strong...
The top of the hourglass.
The top of the hourglass makes that middle look smaller, because there's only so much... Of course, we can lean out or whatever, but the shape of your body in terms of your waist size can be... It's a largely genetic component. Some people have tiny waists and some people are more square-shaped. But if you want to look like you've got that taper, build the shoulders. It's such a... It's beautiful. Beautiful thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I agree. I love, like, my two favorite upper body days are back days, because we start off with pull-ups. Yeah. And then I do two shoulder workouts a week, because I love training shoulders. It's my favorite.
Me too. Yeah.
What do you think of, this is another question I get a lot of, we're kind of meandering into nutrition a little bit, but creatine again, like with the weight, I always get like, but I'm heavier. And it's like, okay, so let's talk about what's happening when we're supplementing with creatine, why we might see, again, another reason why we might see fluctuations on the scale if you're using that as a tool.
Yeah. So, I mean, creatine, anybody who kind of has done any research on it, it is sort of the one muscle building supporting supplement that it really kind of gets the sort of green check across the board in terms of it being incredibly, incredibly well researched and the benefits being really well documented. And it also being one of those supplements that hasn't really undergone the, this is a special effective supplement, so I'm going to jack up the price and make it really inaccessible to people. It's widely accessible. It's widely affordable. And it's widely proven to be beneficial for a large population. What's going to happen, what creatine does is it helps draw water into your muscles, right? Which is why they're I guess in previous iterations of creatine, maybe back in the old school bodybuilding days, you had to like super load with creatine, take a bunch, and it would make you kind of look sort of puffy and you'd have this water weight. And that's again, sort of an outdated issue that a lot of people have with it these days. I mean, creatine monohydrate, again, it's sort of all the same across the board. You take sort of what, 3 to 5 grams regularly, and it's going to help draw water into your muscles. It's going to help you recover and perform and kind of work a little bit harder. And I guess there's also some like brain protective, you know, cognitive benefits from it too. I do use it. I haven't always, because I go through phases where I'm like super keen on like supplementing. I'm just like, yeah, let me just throw everything at it and see what happens. Then I go through phases where I'm like, I can't bother to do anything. I don't care. And I think it's kind of nice as somebody who likes to experiment and learn, I think it's nice to kind of cycle in and out of these phases. And it's always good to not feel like you are too dependent on any one thing. But all that to say, I also eat a really high protein, high animal protein diet that is very high in creatine, I would imagine anyway. If you are eating a lot of red meat, a lot of eggs, things like that, you're getting good creatine in your diet. So I wouldn't say creatine is something you have to take. I wouldn't say that maybe for the majority of people, it's going to have this crazy life-changing improvement, but I do think that it is absolutely a safe and most likely beneficial supplement for a lot of people to take, and women too, because people think, is it just for dudes? Is it just for bodybuilders? And if you are a woman who historically has not eaten a lot of animal protein, does eat sort of a lower protein diet, maybe you're more on the like fish and vegan protein side, some people are, creatine would be a good supplement for you to take. So generally across the board, pretty good product.
It's so important to me that the supplements that I take are of the highest quality. And that's why for 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many other supplement brands, AG1 conducts relentless testing to set the standard for purity and potency. So many people have asked me, hey, is AG1 the real deal? And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by scientific research. They are also NSF certified for sport. And this is one of the most rigorous independent quality and safety certification programs in the supplement industry. And listen, taking care of your health shouldn't be complicated. AG1 simplifies this by making it so there aren't a million different pills and concoctions and capsules to keep track of. It's just one scoop of AG1 mixed in water every day. I love that every scoop contains folate, magnesium, and ashwagandha for stress support, which is so good for perimenopause. And I have partnered with AG1 for so long now because they make such a high quality product that I genuinely look forward to drinking every single morning. If you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2, as well as 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/Stephanie. That's drinkag1.com/my name, Stephanie.
Do you supplement with collagen?
I do. I have actually taken collagen pretty regularly for like a decade now. It's funny, there are a lot of, I don't know, I feel like just recently I've seen a lot more criticisms of collagen. Basically people saying it's like, this is, you know, a marketing scam because it's like this byproduct of meat production, you know, because it's like bovine tendons and hide and even stuff like that. It's like, first of all, I think let's make use of the whole animal. I don't see that as a problem. I think that if we're going to make use
of... And I'm not going to eat the animal tendon. Like, I need it in a different
form.
Some
of us will. Some of us don't. And that's okay.
I know you do. And I know you do. And it's okay. I'm saying for myself, I know myself, I'm not going to have the tendon. I'll have the bone marrow.
But so good.
Tendons are...
Bone marrow is the best. I think collagen is also a good... It's a good supplement, especially if you are dealing with, like, tendon, joint, sort of ligament issues. If you have a history of that, if you have some gut health issues, it can really help there. Collagen is a protein that tends to kind of go to where it's needed. So if you are struggling with any of those things, or, you know, I did feel like when I started taking it, it really improved, like the strength of my skin sort of improved. And I know my digestion got better. I think some people, just due to like sort of lack of information, tend to use it as a replacement for a total protein, and it's not a complete protein. So I wouldn't be using it exclusively for like my protein shakes or something. If you have the ability to kind of use it as a supplement, I think it can be very beneficial. But again, it's not like a panacea, like you need this to be healthy. I think it just can be very beneficial. Yeah.
And I love what you just said there, because I've been asked this question like, oh, does this count towards my protein intake for the day? And the answer is no. It is a protein, but it is maybe the worst protein if we are thinking about stimulating muscle tissue. So yeah, I do. So I typically, out of habit, I will, put some water, like I'm making my water for the gym in the morning, and I'll put in a scoop of collagen, because that's just what I'm, it's just my signal. I'm like, oh yeah, water. I'll put the collagen in there. And then I just get it in that way. But I love collagen. Mm-hmm. I think it's wonderful. And I think, when we think about aging, we tend to lose at the same rate that we are losing muscle tissue for not being strategic. We do tend to lose at a rate of 1% to 2% a year. So the supplementation there can really help to reinvigorate or to replace what is naturally being lost. So my next C, so we did creatine, collagen. Let's talk about carnivore, because I know that you are big into organ meats and, I just mentioned tendons and bone marrow. So there's certain organs that I like to consume. And then there's others where I think it's because, my parents forced me to have liver and onions as a child, and I'm still not over it. So I'm sure you hear that a lot, or maybe you've heard that a lot, but what are some of your favorite, if someone is thinking about, okay, we're going to do nose to tail, because muscle, as we've been talking, like animal proteins, I think we share the opinion, is a superior form of protein when we are thinking about it in terms of nutritional content, complete essential amino acid profile compared to something like a vegan, like a pea protein, let's say. And then I would also say the absorbability of it, the bioavailability of it is better, for example, than the plant proteins. For a lot of people, and maybe this is just a function of the way that we've grown up, we've only ever associated, when we say animal proteins or when we say animal products, we just think about the muscle. We think about, the filet, or we think about the chicken breast, or we think about the pork tenderloin, whatever, the lamb chop. So tell me a little bit about, if we are thinking about consuming organ meats, what are some of the best ones to start off with? And then how can we prepare it if our palate, let's say, is not necessarily habituated to the texture, to maybe the flavor, the taste?
Yeah, I feel so passionately about this, and I will try to be, as succinct and quick as possible. But this is an area that I feel really, really strongly about, so much so that I wrote two cookbooks about it. So if people do want to like learn more and really nerd out about this, I have the two cookbooks. My podcast, I talk about it a lot. I just think it's a really important conversation to be having, especially as, every month there's a new documentary about how red meat's going to kill us, or there's a new documentary about how there's only one moral way to eat. And there tends to be a lot of really special interest driven propaganda and inaccurate, or at least very biased, one-sided conversations about this stuff happening. And I think at the end of the day, if, this is a mostly North American audience, but really worldwide, most people still eat meat. Most people eat animal products. And I think most of us can agree that there are better, more ethical, more sustainable, healthier ways to do that. And so rather than trying to pretend that the planet can become vegan tomorrow, let's have more nuanced conversations about how to eat a human diet in a way that is going to be beneficial and sustainable and ethical and all of those things. And I think organ meats check a lot of those boxes. And one of the reasons, getting back to your initial question, is that first of all, if we're eating muscle meat anyway, we're accepting that animals are dying for us. We're accepting that that's a healthy part of our diet. And organ meats are more nutrient dense across the board than muscle meat. So muscle meat has vitamins and minerals. It has all the essential amino acids that we need, great for muscle building. Organ meats have, and this is almost across the board, some organ meats more than others, have really, really high concentrations of extremely essential vitamins and minerals that help our bodies work. Everything from iron and phosphorus to vitamin A and K and CoQ10, which is a really powerful antioxidant, and so many sort of unsung heroes of the body that just sort of keep us working that we don't even think about until suddenly we get sick or something stops working and we do a blood panel and we're like, oh, we're super low in whatever, you know, probably because we aren't eating a really super nutrient dense diet. And in many cases for women, because we're eating a low red meat diet, right? So if you want to really maximize, even if you want to minimize how much animal protein you're eating for whatever reason, moral reasons, financial reasons, whatever, organ meats tend to be cheaper. They tend to be way, way more nutrient dense, ounce for ounce. And I would recommend that if you're going to kind of just dip your toes in, you're a little nervous, you're worried about texture, you're worried about taste, heart is a really, really good place to start. And just hear me out, people who are like, heart, I'm not eating a heart. Just hear me out. So a heart is a muscle. It's the exact same as your steak, your filet, your tenderloin, whatever. It's a muscle meat. It just also happens to be an organ. Because it's a muscle, it has that very sort of steaky, beefy kind of texture that you're already comfortable with. And it is, again, very, very high in so many B vitamins, A vitamins, CoQ10, like every sort of vitamin and mineral you can imagine. It has a lot more of it than your standard kind of cut of steak. I would also recommend starting with, if you're trying to like go to the butcher shop and get some pieces and kind of experiment, start with the organs of smaller animals. So I know you said you're kind of not into liver, and I can understand that. I could make you a chicken liver mousse that I think you would enjoy, and I would like to be able to do that for you sometime. But if you're looking at the liver, the heart, whatever, of chicken, turkey, lamb, it's going to taste more mild than if you're going straight for the bison liver or the buffalo heart or whatever. Larger animals are going to have a stronger taste. And I'm also a big fan of, so two things if you are looking to get into organ meats, just right off the bat and you're a little nervous. The first one would be go to a restaurant and have a professional make it for you. You mentioned bone marrow. Bone marrow is one that's like widely accepted across the board, just showing sort of how sort of arbitrary and subjective our feelings about what is gross and what isn't. Like you're literally sucking the marrow out of a bone. You don't think anything of it, but we look at a beef heart and we think it's extreme. It's like, it's a different part of the same animal you're already eating, right? So just to kind of expand the thinking around it, but go to a French restaurant and get foie gras or get, you know, a liver terrine or some kind of charcuterie board that has some like fun little.
Actually, I love foie gras.
Right?
I love foie
delicious.
Gras.
Delicious. Yeah.
It is delicious.
Chicken liver mousse, delicious. Go to a Mexican restaurant and get tongue tacos. Tongue is another absolutely delicious cut of meat that I don't know if we even have time to get into, but it's so good. But have somebody who knows what they're doing make it for you so that you can see how good it actually can be, how it's really supposed to taste. It takes all of the sort of fear of you having to like find it and prep it. You just get to enjoy it, right? So just kind of open your palate that way in a very like low stakes way. And if you try it and you don't like it, you literally are right back where you started. You haven't lost anything, but you may try something that's delicious and healthy, and you've kind of, you know, expanded your experience a little bit. So I would say that. And then I would also say, just do what parents have been doing with vegetables from the dawn of time and just sneak it in there, just hide it. So like a very popular thing is to go to a butcher shop and say like, I want some ground beef and I want, you know, a ratio of like 4-to-1 ground muscle meat to liver and heart and kidney or whatever. If you do that sort of 4-to-1 ratio, that's really the sweet spot where you're essentially like boosting the nutrient density of the food without really changing the flavor. Like if you do more of like a 1-to-1, you're going to start tasting some of that like organ meat minerally flavor, which you can like work your way up to if you're into. But if you just put like a 3-to-1, 4-to-1, whatever, you're making your food healthier. And then you can make the burgers, the meatballs, the breakfast sausages, the whatever it is you're already going to make. And it's healthier and it's better for you. and you're not really noticing much of a difference. So those are kind of my initial recommendations off the bat. But I think it's, I think it's an important conversation to have for those. I'm not trying to change vegan dieters. I think when people are ready to hear things, they'll hear them. But for the vast majority of us who recognize that eating meat is a good thing for our health and we just want to do it in the best way possible, I think thinking about organ meats is a valid and reasonable kind of next step.
Yeah. I mean, I have a lot to say on it. Every time I've said something about it, someone makes a, you know, some video about me, but I'll just
tell them to come talk to me. I'm ready for somebody I'm ready to go negatively viral talking about it. I'm ready. So
I've had people do duets with some of the things that I've said. I'm like, oh, for God's
sake.
Anyway, but yeah, I think that there's something to be said around, I mean, for hundreds of thousands of years, we've eaten. We're apex predators for a reason. You see humans on every corner of the earth, or, you know, maybe that's too flat earth-ish. I don't mean corner. All around the globe, okay? So we see humans. We don't see every animal everywhere, right? So we are apex predators. We've learned to adapt to the environment. We've learned to adapt for, and we've learned, and with that privilege, you know, sometimes people talk about privilege like it's a bad thing. And it's like, all right, I do have the privilege of being an apex predator. And what I'm going to do with that is I'm going to honor the cow, the lamb, the chicken, the whatever I'm consuming. I'm going to thank it for it sacrificing its life for me. And then I'm going to take that, integrate its nutrients into my cells, and I'm going to do something good with my life. And that's sort of how I like to think about it. And I, you know, this can sort of expand into other conversations, but I think that, you know, privilege is not, it's like, yes, okay, I'm privileged to be human and not, you know, the elk that someone is hunting. And with that privilege, I am going to thank the animal for its life and for its sacrifice, and I'm going to do something good with it.
And honor your own biology. Like, I tell this very short story a lot because it got me so worked up. When I was pregnant, I was like taking in every bit of information about human nutrition I could, and I was listening to all these podcasts, and I ended up listening to this sort of prenatal nutrition podcast where I found out sort of later that the nutritionists were very like plant-based, plant-leaning. And they gave a piece of advice saying, when you are pregnant, it would be best if you really, really could, unless you're super, super morally opposed, to start eating animal products because they are just so bioavailable, so nutrient dense, so good for the developing fetus. You should really, really prioritize animal protein during pregnancy. And I'm thinking, okay, so when you're building a human, just get rid of all that other rhetoric that you talk about how plant protein is good enough. When it's just you as a woman walking around, go eat suboptimally. Go just kind of barely get by. But when you're creating, but when you're creating a new life, do what's right. But when it's just you, like, whatever, you can just eat some pea protein and like hope for the best. No.
Yeah, I am absolutely aligned with you there. I do think, and to your point, I think that when people are ready to hear the message, they will. I think a lot of people, even who've experimented with vegan, with time, at least this has been, and certainly this may be biased with the population that I serve, but often women will come to me and say, my hair was falling out, I was gaining weight, I was losing muscle mass, I was miserable, I had, you know, sleep was, you know, my teeth were starting to, I was starting to get more cavities, all these different things that sort of change. Yeah. More achy, more you know, more sort of arthritic-like symptoms and presentations. So, you know, you can sort of do it for a while, I think. And I think anything is fine for a while. You can sort of have some type of, I mean, because honestly, the vegan diet is better than the standard American diet. Sure. Like, I would recommend if someone's like, hey, I'm not willing to, you know, have a burger anymore at Burger King or wherever, what's better? The vegan diet is better than that. But what's, you know, it's like, that's okay for time. You know, because you're definitely be having more fiber, you're going to be having more of the phytonutrients, and then we can have a conversation about, you know, plant availability, but all of that, it's better. But what's better than that is to, at least my, for the vast majority of the population, it seems that an omnivorous diet works really well. So high on the animal proteins, and that can include the organ meats, as we've been discussing, and the muscle meat, and then some plants. You know, I love mushrooms, man. I don't think that there's, I could never, if I don't ever have mushrooms again, that would be, I would be very sad.
I had sauteed onions and mushrooms and sausage for lunch right before I came on this call. So, and I mean, again, like, vegan diet, yes, vegans and carnivore-ish people are closer than they are different, really. Yeah, but to your point, it's like a vegan diet is better if it's a Whole Foods vegan diet. Like, you can do a keto diet and it can be really bad. You could do a carnivore diet that is not great. Yeah. I mean, carnivore, again, it's so strict that really you kind of can't really bastardize it too much, but like you can make any of these sort of fad or trendy diets bad or good. I think if you focus on, again, like single ingredient whole foods, and then you personalize it, you know, your carnivore-ish or high protein plate is going to look different than mine and his and hers. And so again, it's like less looking at what other people are doing and more thinking about, use the common sense, use the physiology, and just pay attention to what you need, listen to your body, respond to it, and you're going to get closer than you think.
Beauty. All right, so I'm going to hold you to the chocolate liver. Was it the chocolate liver mousse? Is that what we're doing next time?
So that's there's a chocolate blood pudding that's an Italian specialty that
I love. Okay, so part of my background is Portuguese. So I love like the blood sausage. I love all of
that. Okay, well, I can do that for you.
I got excited.
There's also a chicken liver mousse. I mean, I can send you actually that recipe.
Oh, chicken liver
mousse. That's one of the most popular recipes in the book that I can send. I have a link to it on my website so people can check that out. And if they like it, they can.
Oh, we'll put in the show notes.
And they can go buy the whole book if they like, because that's the tip of the iceberg. But that's one that's just it's very crowd pleasing. Like you put that on a cracker or a carrot and like people are going to like it. And it just shows you it doesn't have to be scary. You don't have to choke down a raw piece of liver to get the health benefits. You can just kind of sprinkle this stuff in here and there, expand your palate, expand your sort of fun in the kitchen, and like be healthier as a result. It doesn't have to be scary.
That's great. I love that. And I actually, I grew up on liverwurst. So it sounds like it's kind of similar. So if you look at liverwurst, it's like there's some kidney, there's some heart, there's some liver, there's kind of stuff in all in there. So I'm already used to that. It's just like the raw liver. I think that's
and like boiled,
something.
You know, like that.
It was boiled. It was boiled. Yeah. And I would, it just wasn't prepared properly. That's 100%. Probably what it was.
It's the same with vegetables. You grow up like kids don't like Brussels sprouts because no one likes a boiled Brussels sprout. Like you got to make it good. You got to throw some bacon in there, put some spices on it, you know, like have some fun with it.
You need to fry it in oil and salt and bacon and there cheese. And that's how you eat a Brussels sprout.
Perfect.
Oh my gosh. Well, this has been such a wonderful conversation. Honestly, it just feels like we've been hanging out.
I love it.
Just chatting about it. It hasn't really felt like a podcast at all for me. So chicken liver mousse, very excited. I'll put that in the show notes and I'm very excited to make it. I'll send you a picture when
I do.
And if people want to find, if they want to buy your cookbook, they want to follow your work, just plug where people can find
you. Thank you. And it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me. It's been awesome. Folks can basically reach out to me. I mean, my website is sort of the place where everything is. So it's just my name, ashleyvanhouten.com. I have some free ebooks there with some recipes around both my cookbooks and some other stuff. My podcast is called Muscle Science for Women, and you should definitely just check out Stephanie's episode first, obviously. And you can,
I mean, there are others.
There's a couple others. Don't worry about it. That's the important one. And then you can say hi to me on Instagram. My handle there is The Muscle Maven. And that's it.
All right. All these links will be clickable in the show notes. Ashley, it's been wonderful. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
All right. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. And I must give you the obligatory legal and medical disclaimer here. This podcast, Better with Dr. Stephanie, is for general information only. And the advice, recommendations we discuss do not replace medicine, chiropractic, or any other primary healthcare provider's advice, treatment, or care. In the consumption of this podcast, there is no doctor-patient relationship that has been formed, and the use and implementation of the information discussed are at the sole discretion of the listener. The information and opinions shared on this podcast are not intended to be a substitute for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. In other words, guys, be smart about this. Take it with a grain of salt. Take this information to your primary healthcare provider and have a discussion with him or her to make the best choice that is for you. Remember, I am a doctor, but I am not your doctor. And these conversations are meant for educational purposes only.